Jagger was really deliberate. He just played with it. It wasn't really serious. Mm. But some people think that Donald just maybe got a bit more into it. And, you know, again, whether he did it as a narcissistic sort of thing or whatever, you know, he liked to start Lucifer Rising, Kenneth Anger's famous film, Lucifer Rising. He plays Lucifer. You know, Donald plays himself Lucifer.
Right. Hello. You're listening to the Jerry Hyde Podcast. And why not? You could be forgiven for asking, does the world really need another podcast? The fact is, as long as there's people on this planet, we need to hear them. We need to give them a platform, and we need places where our voices can be heard, perhaps now more so than ever before. As someone who's been dubbed the most dangerous therapist in the world, I've spent over 25 years talking to people, and in all that time, I've never met a boring person. Because when you really get inside them, when you really open up and find out what makes them tick, every single one of them is a unique container of extraordinary experiences, fantastic stories and radical ideas. That's something I can promise you about this show, is that we will always feature incredibly unusual, game-changing, rebellious, convention-shattering and above all else, exceptional people. And that's because everyone has the capacity to be that if you take the time to get to know them. And then together, maybe, we can make this the most dangerous podcast in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Amadeus Camel. Who's Amadeus Camel, I hear you ask? Well, Amadeus is the person that I go to see when I need to talk to someone, because shrinks need shrinks, and Amadeus is my therapist and has been for the last 4 or 5 years. And you know, every now and again, someone comes along in your life where you go, oh, thank fuck you're here. He's one of the good guys who showed up when the world, you know, when all the good other good guys seemed to be dying, you know, the year that Bowie died and Trump got in and Brexit happened and all that shit hit the fan. That's when I went looking for Amadeus. He's a fascinating character. You'll see as the show unfolds why he's my therapist, why I'm, you know, lucky enough to have met him, why I'm proud to call him my friend. You know, it's when you get to our age and stage, the lines get even blurrier. And hopefully you'll enjoy some of the wormholes we go down as we reminisce and talk about his heritage and my heritage and how they overlap, and you know, some significant themes for me. He's a beautiful soul. He's a therapist. He's an acupuncturist. He's a spiritual teacher, and I hope that you enjoy listening to us ramble on. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Amadeus Camel.
I thought a kind of a little way in, and then we can see where we go. Okay. It was just a little bit of, I suppose, my own synchronicitous backstory. So, just for people to get an idea of what drew me to you ultimately, was that when I was 17, I was involved in this complex, bizarre relationship with a much older woman. Which, like most of the, not all, but most of the abuse stories I've ever worked with, part of the struggle is sifting out the fact that it isn't all bad. A lot of people felt loved by, you know, people of harm or whatever. And so the woman in question, there were some immensely important things that I got from it. One was that unusually for those times, she and her husband had a VHS machine, which was unheard of in a domestic situation in the late 70s, really. It wasn't commonplace. And they had this whole wall of this huge Notting Hill flat. The wall, the kind of doors slid back, and there was this huge classic movie library because her husband was quite a famous film director.
Yeah.
And she turned me on to a series of films over that summer that have, like I said, when we walked in here, this flat, the decor is heavily influenced by some of those films, including Performance, which your father directed. But that film was massive for me, and it took me decades to even begin to understand it, but it just got me as a 17-year-old. There was something about it. Fast forward years later, I think it was 2000. When did Trump get in? 2016. And I went to my supervisor, who's a mutual friend of ours, and said, I need to go back into therapy. Brexit has just happened. Everyone interesting in the world just died, starting with David Bowie, and you know, and then Trump got in. And I remember saying to him, I do not want a therapist who's going to try and fix me. I've spent the last 25 plus years in therapy or working on myself, getting in touch with my feelings. I don't want someone who's going to try and make me feel better. I just want a companion who can sit with me, who's going to get my left field way of thinking. And he said, well, obviously, Amadeus. And he knew, because I talked to him, you know, about my obsession with Performance. And I think that was the bait. He was like, well, you do know that Amadeus's dad directed Performance. He was Donald Cammell. And I was like, okay. I mean, we'd met before and I liked you. And then obviously the last 4 years now, I suppose we've been working, and it's been great. It's exactly what I was looking for, which was that kind of companionship.
Excellent.
But I thought that, you know, that's an interesting little thing to throw in so that people know, you know, about what pulled us together inevitably. And let's get that out of the way would be my sense, because I don't want to sit here and just talk to you about your dad any more than I want to talk about my fucking dad. But it's a rare opportunity, I suppose. Hopefully not a role reversal, but a rare opportunity for me to pick your brains about you and your life rather than you talking to me about mine, to kind of redress that imbalance, which I'm quite excited about. But as I understand it, you didn't really know Donald.
Yeah, not at all, not personally. Yeah, he kind of scarpered 3 weeks after I was born. I mean, he'd left when my mum was...
How did your parents get together? When did they meet?
Do you know, I don't know many of those details, but it was in art school. My mum was studying drama. Donald, of course, was...
In London, was it?
In London. Right. Yeah, the London School of Art and Drama, whatever she was called. And so they were both students. Donald is... As we know, infamously, he would sleep with anybody he could, the women, and he was kind of pretty irresistible. So he was not turned down. He wasn't used to it. And my mom had just come from Greece, you know, had not long just arrived in Greece, which again was really quite an incredible story, because in Greece was just after the Civil War, which was a really, really heavy time. And after the war, it was really bad. There was hardly any food. My mum used to, she said, the way she survived, she used to knock door to door because she had temping skills, proper secretarial schooling that she had learned previously, and said, I'll type any letters or anything you want for bread and soup. And that's how she got by for the best part of 2 years. And then she went to a beauty contest and won it. And on the back of that, she went on to another one, which was about becoming Miss Greece, and she won that. So she came to London, because in that year, 53, I believe it was, Miss World was taking place in London. So she came to London as simply as Miss Greece. Okay, she didn't win it. But when she was here, she managed to wrangle it somewhere or other to stay, to study.
Right.
And that was her ticket out of Greece at the time, which was a, you know, a real hole. And not long after that, she met Donald. And because she came from the culture she came, more than anything, but also because she knew how to get Donald, she was besotted with her because she was really beautiful. I mean, you know, Miss Greece. I mean, you should see photographs. And there are in Donald's books and stuff. I mean, she was a real stunner. And he couldn't resist her. And he said, no, I won't sleep with you, Donald, unless you marry me. I just don't do that. So he said, okay, fuck it. I'm just going to have to marry you. And in the end, they were married 5 years. It wasn't just a, you know. But, of course, it didn't last because she couldn't resist the skirt. As my mum used to say, she couldn't resist skirt. And she was pretty liberal for a time and being Greek. She was really like, she knew, everybody would say, you know, Donald is just sleeping with everybody he can behind your back. And she said, as long as it's behind my back, as long as it's not humiliating me. And he was very discreet, actually. He was really, you know, he wasn't doing it as a sort of cutest thing. He just couldn't resist women. But it was, he didn't want to be a father. So when my mum first time got pregnant, she did have an abortion. And we're talking now the 50s, so it was, you know, illegal.
Yeah.
Second time, obviously, I was kind of rather smart to what kind of night, clued into what was going to happen. So when she was pregnant with me, she kept on having periods, but she started developing a lump in the belly. So she said, God, what's going on here? She went to the doctor. This was fire, you know, and then the doctor said, oh, my God, you have a tumor. You know, you're having periods. Oh, you're not pregnant. Okay. Rush to the hospital. Immediately, the ambulance turns out of the clinic. She's at the hospital because she lived in Hampstead. They lived in Hampstead. And there they were. And they already sedate her and rush her to the theater because they think she's got some kind of large growing tumor. And she was half going and she barely hears the surgeon just before she goes off for a sleep. She says, saying, this woman is not got a tumor. She's pregnant. What? Get her out of here. And so 5.5 months pregnant. And Donna was saying, well, you know, I don't do children. And she says, it's too far gone. I'm not going to some, you know, back room thing, even though, you know, you can pay doctors. You know, it was a doctor, but it said, but then the doctors that they would have gone wouldn't touch it at that stage. They'll go, sorry, you know, I can risk it, but not at that stage. You know, if I get caught, that's it.
So you snuck through.
So she said, and then she somehow also felt the impulse, the impetus for me to be here, and something had also, she did want to have children. I mean, a great woman always wants children. And she said, Donald, you're just going to have to, you know, grin and bear it. But he wouldn't. So I said, right, it's either the kid or me.
And did you ever get any information as to why he was so averse to that?
No.
Encroaching on his style.
No book has got into the therapeutic dynamics of that. You know, he grew up in a conventional family, pretty much.
Apart from the fact his godfather was Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, right? Well, that is one other thing. Yeah, exactly. That's another story. But it directly, immediately, no, he just wanted to be free to be an artist. The story he was, parents said, he just wasn't.
You say conventional family, what? Two up, two down suburbia?
More than surely suburbia, not. You know. No, upper class. He came from upper class.
He's Scottish.
Scottish upper class, yeah. Camelard, millionaires, you know, until my grandfather nearly blew it all. And my grand, and whatever was left over was probably blown by the three brothers. But yeah, so you know, they had, you know, as you know, that was his story. It's all in the book, how he was tutored at home, never went to school. It was all home tutoring.
I've never read the book. I must read the book.
Yeah, home tutoring and, you know, very upper class, Camilla, you know. This sort of noble Scottish family, you know.
And from the work I've seen, an extraordinarily gifted artist.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, he was considered to be the best artist of his generation, which was interesting because after he died in Scotland, they voted him the best director of his generation, best Scottish director of his generation.
Right.
But at the time, in his early 20s, he was already being, you know, peddled around as being the best life artist, maybe not all types of art of his generation. And he was early 20s. He had an exhibition at the Tate.
He was my hero at art school in the early 80s because I was, you know, everyone was doing their abstract stuff and all I wanted to do was paint and draw life drawing and figurative stuff. And all the interviews I went to at art schools were like, this is old hat. No one wants figurative stuff anymore. But Donald was the most impressive life artist for me.
Yeah. No, he was very well taught anyway. So, no, he was very skilled. But, of course, famously, as soon as the 60s hit and in the art world started changing, he turned his back on it. You know, even though he was lauded as being, and he was making serious money from it. You know, he was doing the portraits of all the nobility, you know, the aristos, the British aristos, you know.
Do you have any of his art?
No, not those. Oh, yeah, I have some of the ones he did, you know, portrait of my mother and portrait of an old man. We don't know who he is. They're very, very good. I mean, and other, some sketches that are brilliant. I mean, I love his sketches even more than the actual paintings. They're just so natural. And some stuff that... it's almost like Beardsley. He's done some surreal stuff. You could see he was already getting more into the more kind of otherworldly side, but there isn't much. I mean, at that time, my mum obviously didn't want to keep much of his art because, you know, after being abandoned like that, she hadn't much, you know, whatever.
So he left her with just you with no income and
nothing. Yeah.
Buggered off and left her in Hampstead.
No, she took him to court. A judge said, yeah, you have to pay whatever it is, you know, a shilling and threepence, like those days, for the upkeep of the child. He never paid a penny. My mum always said, the thing is that he could have, but never did. And that's what really got to her. It was like, it's not a pauper.
Mm.
But he just wouldn't want to acknowledge. And he's never acknowledged. In fact, I don't know anyone who hasn't read his story who said, and then they said, that's a bit like Donald's name. He said, so yeah, I'm his son. And they'll go, he had a son? I never knew. I said, yeah, you never told. He never spoke about it, you know. Mm. Others may have said it, but he never said it.
So he never had other children?
He never had any other children. And when he remarried Sheena, you know, the whole agreement was, you're not going to have children. There's even rumor that he made sure by, you know, she had going... and being snipped, you know, making sure she couldn't have, or he got snipped rather. No, he got snipped. Right. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. He got snipped. And that's I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, because he was definitely not wanting anything to interfere with his career, with his world, or with his work, with his art, you know, with his exploration, you know. But I think there's deeper psychological stuff going on, which, whatever they are just. But I have nothing to really pin it on.
And did you know, you said that his brother, David, died yesterday.
The day before yesterday, right. Yeah, so I was told yesterday.
Did you know his side, Donald's side of the family at all? Did you know your grandparents?
No, my grandfather died when I was 3, which is a shame, Charles, because he was really quite a character too, very nice. And he really liked me. He was the one who, he kept in touch with my mum, Maria. He was the one who gave me my name. He's the one who came up with Amadis because he was a romantic. And Amadis, you know, from the Parsifal is another name for Parsifal.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. In some story, Parsifal has a name. You know,
I assumed it was a Greek name.
No, it's a Latin name originally. It's Amadeus, which just means love God. But then the name fell out of use. But it was used in Scotland more. So, you know, apparently until the 19th century, there would be the odd Scots guy who would call Amadis.
Right.
And that's where my grandfather said, well, that would be a cool name. It's romantic. It sounds Greek, but it isn't Greek. And that's like Amadis. He's also Scottish. So, yeah, that's the story behind the name.
And when did you become, did it just kind of filter into your life who Donald was and what he'd done? When did you first see performance? When did you start to become aware?
Well, I think like when I first saw performance, completely went over my head. I thought, what the hell is this? But I was young. I mean, I was, you know. And I think, let's say, after the uses of certain substances, I saw performance again. And then it made sense from that perspective, you know, the whole, that aspect of it.
I never watched it on acid, actually. I used to go and see Apocalypse Now on acid, but I never watched performance
no,
on acid.
No, I mean, just having smoked.
Right.
Having smoked. But also by then, having lived, as I said, I instinctively created a bedroom which was a replica of how, you know, the bedroom they had. When my mum saw it, she said, that's just like the bedroom we had.
Mm.
And it was, you know, very oriental drapes and, you know, very hippie. And, I mean, this is very proto-hippie because my mom, this is in the 50s, so he was already going that way. Moroccan and all that stuff was already filtering into his
work. I spent some time in Tangier last summer. I think that was one of the hangouts, wasn't it?
Definitely. Yeah, they spent time in Canary, you know, they were hanging out there. You know, real beatniks. Yeah. My mum, they lived a beatnik, a charm beatnik life. They were both very charismatic, beautiful, both of them charming and beautiful. So they kind of lived off people with money. So they were hanging out in yachts of rich, the rich, and whilst they were being penniless beatniks, but they could afford it, you know, because they were like, so, you know, it was nice when it, you know, the marriage was good when it, whilst it lasted. You know, my mum was, you know, she said it was very, something interesting. But he was actually different to what he became later, in the later 60s. By then he had morphed. You know, he is a different character in the 50s. Not necessarily more conventional, even though he was, but it was pre-drugs. So he wasn't turned on. So he hadn't that definite imagination. But also, I think he just liked, he was more of his upbringing, you know, slightly privileged, elite, you know, effete, dilettante lifestyle, which suited him.
Certainly in Keith Richards' autobiography, he talks about Donald as someone he disliked intensely and as being quite a Machiavellian character.
Yeah, that sort of comes in later on. And again, it's who you speak to, who you read. I think people either loved or loathed him.
Mm-hmm.
Really, he was, you know, he was not vanilla, as you would say, famously say. Mm-hmm. He was not vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely Marmite.
So when you, there's a really important piece. I said we weren't going to talk about my dad or your dad too much, but we're in it, so tough. A really big, crucial piece of therapeutic work for me over the years has been to extract the bits from my father that I appreciate from the beast. And so there are qualities that I recognize that I've inherited from this extremely damaged human being that I really value. I mean, they may sound silly, but he had, he had all his clothes tailor-made in Savile Row. He had handmade shoes. I appreciate good clothes, even though I don't look like I do. He had fantastic hi-fi in the 60s. You know, he's an audiophile. He's very well read. He's very well traveled. He's got certain sensibilities that I can resonate with, that I feel I've inherited from him, that I'm glad of, and a shitload of stuff within myself that I really, can, with through my work with you and all the other work I've done, try to contain. What, with the little, you know, well, contact, zero contact you've had with your father. But when you look at his body of work and when you hear about him and you hear about this Marmite character, what did you get? How does Donald live in you?
Well, it's the whole camel thing. It's more the camel thing. I draw inspiration from Charles Camel, who was an artist, a poet, an author. I mean, he wrote, you know, he wrote poetry, you know. He wrote books, autobiography of the family, like Castles in the Air, he called them, you know. I mean, there's a whole, I mean, Donald is preceded by 2-3 generations of very interesting and kind of almost dynamic men. The great-great-grandfather who became this Victorian, classically Victorian, and developed the camel-led shipyards, which still are in Glasgow, the camel shipyards and stuff. They haven't belonged to the family since after the First World War. But he was a huge industrialist, I mean, massive. Became very rich, but also became very rich on the back of the exploitation of the Glasgow workers, who, as we know, famously lived in hovels. So, you know, he was one of these classic Victorians, you know, and his son followed suit. And then his son was my grandfather, which something happens because he grows up, he's very much colored by the Edwardian mindset, which I've noticed with us, where these very rich kids become something totally different to their fathers and grandfathers. They turn away from almost the brutishness of the Victorian ethos and become Edwardian sophisticates, you know, into the Art Nouveau, into all that arts and crafts, new thought, new thinking. And that was the new man. And Charles was definitely one of these, very beautiful too, you know, with his long beard, moustache, and he's always wearing a beret. You know, interesting, he used to wear a beret. He was very maverick, very eccentric. And my mom says she probably married Donald because she fell in love more with Charles than actually Donald. Maybe that's the story she tells herself now. But so Donald was the son of also an incredible individual, you know. And I would say he really was the real thing. I think Donald got something of that and developed it because of the new technology. He could develop it in the way he did with film, I mean, hence became more well-known. But however much I would be intrigued to meet and talk to my father, I would die to be able to have talked to Charles, you know. And Charles said, I want to give him the way in Amity. That means love of God. I know he's going to be a really spiritual person. I have that sense. So he tuned into me. And he was a spiritual person. He was the first editor of Light magazine, which I don't think is published anymore. But it was, you know, one of those things that started in the early 20th century, you know, that blossoming of thought in anthroposophy, you know, theosophy, all that stuff, spiritualism, new thing, you know, Gurdjieff, you know, all this, you know, and Steiner. And Charles was dead into that. And so the Light magazine was dedicated to that, a hefty dose of spiritualism as well as other stuff, which actually, I didn't know about that until after I'd got myself involved with spiritualism again. Right. It was like there was something there and somebody said, oh yeah, you know, there's some hall in some spiritualist church, which is dedicated to him, like to Charles Camel. And there I used to go to spiritualist church, not for the lectures, that's where I got turned on as a 15-year-old. I thought, first of all, gosh, I got to check out all this weird psychic stuff my mum is into, because she was into it. And then I got turned on to things like yoga and Rajneesh, because, you know, there used to be a lecture shirt circuit from a tender age of 15, 16. And that's why I got into all that at that young age.
Right.
But behind it all, I get the feeling Charles, him now in the, you know, in the other, on the other side, kind of putting some vibes, influencing me. I don't think Donald did in that way. I think Donald was on his own trip.
So did you ever make any efforts to contact Donald?
Yes. Yes, I did. More than once. Yeah. It just wasn't up for it.
Right.
Got very close. I mean, I did meet him once. Yes.
When you were how old?
That 21.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what happened there? What was that like?
He was here doing a shoot. I forget which film it was he was doing. This would have been in 1981. Would it be The White of the Eyes or something? Anyway, he was doing a film shoot and he was in England. And so his brother, who has, you know, just passed away, David, kind of, because I wanted to meet him, really kind of hassled him and said, come on, Donald, for fuck's sake, you're here, you're living in Chelsea. He is living, because at the time I was, he's living in our mother's flat because she'd passed away. And that's in Edith Place in Chelsea.
Mm.
You know, which I was living for a year whilst they were going to sell it, you know, shortly after she passed away. Again, I only met her once. And again, just bumped into her in King's Road with my mum. And my mum said, oh, hi, Iona. That was her name. And Iona looked at me. I said, this is Amadeus. And she looked at me and said, nothing. I mean, literally nothing. And she acknowledged, you know, and just walked on, which was like keeping the family tradition. But there was no love lost between Iona and my mum. I mean, I think they detested each other right from the beginning, because I think Iona never forgave my mom for Donald being in love with another woman other than her. She's a very narcissistic woman, as far as I can tell. Whilst the father wasn't, Charles wasn't, but the mother was very... So, yeah, so I blame that the mother ruined the children, you know. And so I did meet him. We went out in a restaurant. I don't think it's there anymore, but some kind of restaurant in King's Road. But of course, he made sure that there was other there. He had David there. He had Sheena there, his wife. And he had one of his managers there. So when we never spoke directly. We just sat around the table and never quite spoke. And I was saying, in me, I was going, give him space. You don't want to frighten him off. You don't go in too fast, too hard. You know, he'll take flight.
Mm.
Even at 21, I went, take it easy. Just make him feel comfortable. The guy's obviously got the jitters. I mean, I didn't have any charge at the time. It was all too buried. All my anger and disappointment and rage towards him was still completely, you know, unaware of it, that it even existed. So at that time, I think I was pretty safe. But, and then that was the meeting. And then in the evening, I said, well, let's meet up and talk. He said, yeah, let's talk. And I go around to his place and then, and he said, I remember he offered me a spliff because he said, oh, I always have a spliff in the afternoon, in the evenings. I said, at the time I wasn't smoking. I said, no, thanks, you know, that's it. So he said, whiskey, no. He said, oh, I'll be with it. I've just got to make a few phone calls to New York or somewhere in America, California. Anyway, and he never comes out until the very late evening. I hang out with Gina, hang out with David. And then later on, he said, oh, let's go to the movies. You know, so I said, oh, okay, let's go to the movies. So, of course, we go to the movies and watching Raiders of the Lost Ark, which just come out, which he was very critical of. But anyway, and then I said, oh, we'll see each other. I thought, okay, we've broken the ice. Never saw him again.
Wow. And how much longer after, what year did he kill himself?
97.
Okay, so.
96, 97. Yeah.
Good while after.
No, I mean, it was like, and he said, oh, yeah, we'll see each other. Yeah, call me. And I kept on calling him and even trying to speak to him. Wouldn't even speak to me on the phone. Every time excuses. Then say, I've got to go off. And then after about 3-4 weeks of that, I rang up his brother and said, listen, David, tell Donald. If he wants to meet me, he knows where the fuck to find me. Otherwise, I'm not calling him anymore. This is taking the piss. I never heard from him again. Right. He buggered off back to America and that was it, you know.
And when he killed himself, what was the impact on you? Because I've been kind of waiting for that call about my dad for years, which hasn't come.
But. Yeah, it's interesting. It was surreal, I think, because by then I got in touch with my rage against him, the total rejection of me, and maybe I was also carrying a lot of the rage of my mother, which I'm sure I was, because it was in the womb. You know, he left her whilst I was in the womb, so I'm sure I absorbed all that energy, all those hormones of anger and despair and betrayal and heartbreak. So all that stuff. But I was really disappointed that I always thought before he died, maybe even on his deathbed, he'd say, I got to say goodbye to my son. Some kind of romantic stuff, like some kind of Hollywood script, something. Say, you know, sorry for, you know, I could only do what I could do. And I would say, yes, I understand. You had to live your own way. It's all right. It's good that we connect now. Never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt like a body blow. That felt like, it felt like, yeah, the guy just never did care. You know, I mean, just like there was nothing. You wouldn't, you know, it was a total, the ultimate rejection. It was the ultimate F you. You know, not me personally, but to everything, but to even to me. And it was, I had a premonition. So, and somebody else must have had a premonition. I forget his name. I'm terrible with names, so you'll have to forgive me. But a Sunday Times supplement were doing a piece on Donald, which I still got. It was a big one. It was like 6 pages. You remember when the Sunday Times did this big, heavy, yeah. I think once. Anyway, so they did a whole one on Donald. And I think it was because it was something to do with some anniversary. But anyway, and that was about a couple of years before he killed himself. And this guy once came to my practice as at the time I was only acupuncture. He said, I want treatment. And he said, oh, by the way, he feigns, are you at all associated with Donald? And I said, oh, yes, I am. Of course, he knew. I mean, died. He was a hack doing a piece. So he wanted to get some story from me. Like, okay, what happened in your day? And then he said, actually, do you mind if I interview you about it? Actually, I'm here not for a treatment. You know, this is a lie. I came to talk to you. Can we? So I said, well, I'll have to charge you for the treatment. I said, you've taken my. I said, oh, yeah, no, please. So he paid for the treatment. And the next time we actually have a proper talk, a chat, he came and chatted. And the long and short of it was that he didn't get much info from me because I didn't have only what I know, telling you now, pretty much the same story. And he said, I really would like to see if I can be a catalyst for you and your dad to meet. I know he comes to England because this is where we're doing the interviews. He was only in my office a couple of weeks ago. He's coming in 2 weeks.
Wow.
If I can wrangle it, would you want to meet him? I said, I'd love to. And then I said, great. And I said to him, and when you next talk to him, give him my love, I said to this guy. He said, yeah. And then so he rang me about 5 days later. And he said, I haven't been able to pin Donald down to meet with you. But I'm sure I'll work on it next time I see him. Meanwhile, he says he sends you his love. That's the last real contact we had of him through another person saying he sends you his love. And I thought, right, we're going to meet then. Obviously, he wouldn't say that. But he came and went, never saw me.
Where did performance come from, do you think? Where in his psyche did that bubble out of?
I think that came partly through what Charles was into and all that sort of stories and breeding.
And I think of performance, something very chaotic got conjured. And I know that, you know, Anita Pallenberg, perhaps Jagger, they were dabbling in some esoteric shit that you probably don't want to fuck around with. In Cheney Walk, I know there was reports of all sorts of spooky stuff going on because they were doing seances and what have you. And for me, performance, part of it is ritualistic, and there's a magic There's a dark magic to that movie that really touched something in me.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I think there was a lot of, I think it was very dilettante. And I mean, in the real meaning of the word, like they were playing around with things that probably they didn't know, and being very 60s and slightly like, yeah, why the hell not? You know, I mean, is that, I love that Arthur Lee line in his song saying, I like magic. Why? Because it is so quick.
Right.
You know, the stanza, I like magic. Why? Because it is so quick. And I think there was that attitude. They didn't really know. And again, people say, yeah, I mean, particularly Jagger was really deliberate. He just played with it. It wasn't really serious. Mm. But some people think that Donald just maybe got a bit more into it. And, you know, again, whether he did it as a narcissistic sort of thing or whatever, and, you know, he liked to star, you know, in Lucifer Rising, Kenneth Anger's famous film, Lucifer Rising. He plays Lucifer, you know, Donald plays himself Lucifer.
Right.
And we know that Kenneth Anger was more seriously into all sorts of that sort of occult stuff.
But this is why I'm glad we kind of took this line of inquiry, because as we talk about it, I go, well, of course, here you are.
Yeah.
Of course you're from this lineage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and your interests and the way you've lived your life.
Yeah. Yeah, and also in reaction, I mean, I think Donald had more of an effect of like in a reaction. It was both the positive attraction and the positive repulsion of what he represented to me. So I sort of went to the other extreme, you know. I went into stoic mysticism, Buddhism, Taoism, you know, even for 3 years was a kind of thought of myself, maybe not 3 years, but more like 2 years, thought of myself as a kind of born-again Christian, really, you know, sort of like in reaction. I needed to react.
Mm.
And even if I was thinking, why the fuck am I going to this born again Christian? I liked the music. It was real rock and roll. I mean, those bands was thrashing out full on rock and roll, not just acoustic, you know, mayhem. It was like a primal session, you know, which I thought, I like this. This is like, apart from the frame, this is mayhem. Mm. This is total in spirit, you know, being taken over by the spirit. And these guys were like completely giving themselves freedom to, whilst this trash.
But again, sorry to keep bringing it back to performance, but that's my favorite line. The only performance that makes it is the one that achieves madness.
Yeah. I know. I was so attracted to it. I mean, and it was great for a while. I mean, of course, there was all the sort of the philosophy, you know, the doctrine that comes after it. So it is interesting, you know, whatever it comes from, something very primitive from our consciousness in the hindbrain. I mean, as my John Pierakis, who I trained with, you know, become a quantum therapist, you know, he said, don't forget, we've got millions of years of terror locked away in our reptilian brain. And terror being like just basically, you know, flight or fight.
Yeah.
That's all it is. He says, that's where the demons are. That's where the fear is. That is the thing. We've got to somehow sublimate our reptilian brain, because it's millions of years of information, for fuck's sake. You know, how do you convert that to something sublime? You know, or is it always going to be there? And my sense now in my 60s is saying, always something of that remains. You know, just I always thought always something of the ego remains. And we would say, I have no ego. And you think, well, you've got the biggest ego, you know, famously Rajneesh, love him or loathe him, you know, I have no ego. I'm enlightened. I said, come on, guy, you got the fucking biggest ego I've known. And I love you for it, because it gives you such audacity. But at the same time, don't pretend you don't have an ego. You know, it's nonsense, you know. And what is the big deal about not having an ego? As long, if your ego is beautiful, I mean, it's to beautify it, to transform it and make it something exalted that channels the beauty of our being, you know, which we have, you know. you know, from those the highest levels of consciousness that we can tap into. And that's what I've been into for 45 years, is getting into that state. You know, that's been my big trip, if you like, my hobby, you know, the sort of transcendental states of consciousness, as well as making as much of that as imminent as one can make it, more present in the here and now and embody it. So it's not just detached out there, but actually becomes more and more part of our personality.
Mm.
But after 45 years, I realized, you know, we're always going to have this part of our personality that is animal, that is existential. That's how those are our genes. We can't deny them. And if we pretend we're not them, I think that's where madness lies. I think that's where the danger lies.
Yeah.
You could see, you know, with when Rajneesh really starts believing his own hype, his own thing about being this great master or whatever, that he starts making mistakes, that things start going crazy around him. You know, he starts not be, you know, start, but it's such a big thing, isn't it? Not to be,
I think power yeah. is a drug that drives people insane more than any other, perhaps.
Yeah.
And we're not taught in our culture to manage power.
Yeah.
In fact, in England, you're kind of taught to be quite subservient and play everything down and not be too big for your boots, those kind of expressions.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not an English thing. I mean, you look around the world at the moment, there are very few men in power who are doing it particularly good job of managing it. It drives people fucking nuts.
Mm.
You know, and it is. It's I adore the Greek myths more than any other culture because they really understood psychology and all those kind of, you know, labyrinthine places that people go to and craziness of the gods even, you know, is so palpable. And I think you're right. I've recently been saying, slightly tongue in cheek, but with actually absolute truth, that this fucking David Icke nonsense about shape shifting lizard people. Mm. I've started to subscribe to the belief that the House of Windsor and the Bush dynasty and the Kennedys and now the Trumps are shape shifting lizard people.
Mm.
I believe it. I just think there's a metaphoric thing rather than a literal thing. Of course they're fucking lizards. Their lizard brains are so overdeveloped compared with perhaps people who are denying their lizard brains. Maybe they just got no filter and they're ruthless motherfuckers like any reptile. They're cold-blooded. They will kill, steal, rape, you know, tear anyone to pieces to achieve their ends. And I try and keep my lizard brain in control because I don't want to be a complete cunt.
Well, again, it's that pretend. Yeah, and it's so interesting that, I mean, exactly that's what Hillary, my wife, says. You know, she says, yeah, David Icke. Yeah, but it's just, it's a metaphor. It's like the demons, you know, the demon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You are possessed by the demon. Yeah, the inner demon has possessed you, that rage and hatred and malice has finally let rip because it's been so stifled that it comes out and is out of control and one has no say on it. That's the dangerous bit. But yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, King Lizard, I mean, funny enough, I was watching a little thing of an interview of on YouTube. I like watching YouTube last thing at night. And, you know, one of my favorites, Jim Morrison, you know, again, somebody I didn't understand more and more the older and get, even though it's hard to believe he died when he was 27. But he was saying stuff when he was 23, 24 that was so wise. Like, understand, you know, really there's something about in interviews and he's talking like a 50-year-old about really objective about what is culture and what's going on with the hippie thing. And then, I mean, with total detachment and clarity, no identification with any of it, as if he's just like some kind of wise man. And you're thinking, bloody hell! But of course,
Do you know what it says on his gravestone?
Well, he owns the lizard, the King Lizard.
But that's not what it says on his gravestone.
No, what does it say?
And I've been, you know, I go from time to time when I'm in Paris. I kind of pop around and see him. And I remember going to his grave in maybe 1984 for the first time, and there was a kind of, it was a bit like a public toilet.
Mm.
There was a really bad stone bust of him on the grave, covered in graffiti, and everyone leaves kind of cigarette lighters and joints and stuff, and it was just a fucking mess. And then apparently someone nicked the bust, and it was unmarked for a while. And then I found it really, there's a very touching interview with his father. His father, I mean, it gets more bizarre by the minute. His father was the admiral in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. So the whole false flag thing that brought Vietnam into the Vietnam, the Americans into the Vietnam War, where they alleged that the American fleet was attacked by North Vietnamese boats, which was turned out to be utter bullshit. He's Admiral Morrison was Jim's dad. So they didn't, like you and Donald perhaps, or me and my dad, they didn't have a whole lot in common. They were estranged. And when years later, after Jim had died, that I saw an interview with his father, who had, I found it very moving. I suppose it's because it's what I wanted. His father had kind of buried the hatchet and gone, wow, I actually get my son now. And I accept him as an artist. And he had a new tombstone made for Jim. And in Greek, it says on it, "To his faithful to his own demon."
Yeah.
But spelt D-A-I-M-O-N.
Daimon. So yeah, Greek.
The guardian angel, I suppose. Or the, and again, back to performance. It's what Anita Pallenberg says when James Fox shows up about Jagger. He says he's to explain his kind of limpness or lack of spirit. She says he's lost his demon.
Which is an old, it's just kind of alluding back to something, you know, the Greek daemon, daemon in Greek, or daemonas in modern Greek. But it is a primal spirit force, a primal in Greek. And it was literally demonized by the Christians because that had become so much part of the Greek culture about connecting to the daemon, because they were not seen as either benevolent.
It's kind of nature spirit.
Yeah, or malevolent, but just a force. But of course, like all these things.
Pan.
Yeah. And you know, and of course, you know, that's what I'm saying. You know, the person like somebody who we can identify, like Jim Morrison, who owns that lizard brain, he said, you know, I am the king lizard. But that allows him to also find that exalted place, you know, as he says, that lovely phrase, stoned immaculate. Like, wow, what a phrase. I mean, just he understands what's to be immaculate. But only because he also somehow manages in his very short lifespan to connect to something much more primal and primitive. And I, but it like, and I think, you know, it would be fascinated if Donald had died when he was 27, which would have been a bad deal because, you know, I wouldn't have been around. But the fact was, because even then he might have been like that flame that, that we would have known and wouldn't have kind of got older and would have just kept that immaculate state that you get when you're young. Because I still say to people, and I sometimes mean it and sometimes I think, oh, I'm just talking nonsense. But there are times I'm saying, you know, where are you getting to now? You, do you really feel you're arriving, you're discovering something? He said, I really am. I really feel I'm coming back to myself, that I've come back to myself, my real self, whatever that is. And they said, oh, that's great. And I said, but it's also, I feel I'm slowly but surely coming back to the 18-year-old self, which I feel was the pinnacle of my on earth. I was at my most pure and exalted and happy and content and centered and empowered and honest and bold. I mean, so bold, you know, during 18, just living. I remember I never made a penny and I just lived off the grace of God. You know, I mean, really the true hippie ideal, you know, I'm not making. And yet, after that, it gets lost. You know, after that, by my 20s, by 20, I knew I had lost that magic that 18 and 90 I could keep. And I thought I was going to have it forever.
But that's the Parsifal myth, isn't it? That the youth gets a glimpse of the grail.
Yeah.
But it slips through yeah. his hands and has to go off and quest for decades more to find his way back to the Grail. And it reminds me of a conversation we had a few weeks ago about authenticity. And, you know, you're talking about Osho, and who's obviously I'm a big fan of also, with certain caveats. But I love his quote about authenticity being an incredibly dangerous state. And I really rail against the softer, you know, I mean, I'm quite disparaging about the therapy world in general, even though I'm balls deep in it. But I rail against the kind of soft, fluffy dream catcher whale song CD part of New Age stuff. And the way I feel that people use the word authenticity very lightly, like it's a pink fluffy thing. Fucking dangerous, because I think probably the most authentic people on this planet are people with Tourette's, you know, zero filter. And if you have zero filter, you're going to piss on, you know, upset a lot of people off. But of course, when we're 18, we have a kind of delicious taste of that I don't give a fuck attitude that I think can be very authentic. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then certainly for myself, I lost it and had to find my way back and kind of tried to fit in. It's like, I said fuck you to society for ages, and then I was like, I didn't mean it, I just want to belong, and became a therapist and got a BMW and started wearing slacks from Paul Smith and all this shit. And then it was like, who the fuck am I? And what happened to that 18-year-old? So I can kind of relate to you on that.
Yeah.
And I think at this stage of my life, at 56, I feel like a kind of mostly happily balanced hybrid of perhaps not straight, but, you know, together, ordered, you know, got my shit together, mostly fairly professional and established in that, whilst also being rebellious. And it's that Mick Jagger, James Fox hybrid, you know, the wholeness that I find so important and exciting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. You know. I think, you know, going back to Donald, I think my misgiving about him is I think he got beguiled a bit by fame. Not fortune. He was brilliant with fortune. You know, he never sold out on his integrity of doing the films he wanted to, and you wouldn't edit them just to get them published. I mean, as we know, not just with performance, but also The Wild Side and all sorts of stuff. Because he was true to his art. But I think, you know, the thing of his own sense of who he was got the better of him, and then he couldn't live up to it anymore. I think he committed suicide because he felt he could never live up to what he had been, to what he'd achieved, basically quite young, you know. And as you've probably heard, you know, they say it's both brilliant, but it's a tragedy that the band's best work is their first album. You know, that's the worst bloody fate that can befall you, because you're constantly trying to live up to something that's already happened. And so, you know, and I think that's what happened with Donald, that his best work was his first work. That's my theory. I've not read that anywhere, that he couldn't quite, he tried and tried. And that, then he kind of said, well, that's no point. I'll never get there.
No, I discussed this with, one of the first people I interviewed for this podcast, a photographer called Tim Page, who had a significant chunk of his brains blown out in Vietnam when he was 24, and actually has gone on to be quite a successful photographer and artist throughout his life. But we were talking about that, and I was referencing a photograph I've got upstairs of Jimi Hendrix and Noel Redding, the bass player, sitting just behind him. And he left the Jimi Hendrix experience when he was 21. That's one of my worst nightmares. I desperately hope that I've got my best work ahead of me. But that idea, as an artist, loosely using that umbrella term for myself, the idea to, you know, I mean, the Beatles, I think John Lennon was what, 28, 29 when the Beatles broke up? You know, Paul McCartney was the same. George Harrison would have been 27 or 28. I mean, that's one thing to have created a body of work, but to know that it's over. Noel Redding, I think, just played acoustic guitar in pubs around Ireland until he dropped dead from a heart attack or aneurysm or something. That to me is terrifying. So I think your theory is probably quite sound. Surely it's every artist's worst nightmare. I've actually given it my best shot. It's over. And I've heard people say, you get 10 years as an artist. You get that kind of 10-year, you know, and you can apply it to the Beatles, the Stones, Dylan. Bowie, I think, broke the mold slightly. I think Dylan is still evolving. But in terms of the great work, is there an artist that's broken the 10-year kind of allocation? You know, Picasso, I suppose. But there's going to be exceptions. But I think there's truth to it. And it must be awful to go, fuck it, I'm over the hill.
Yeah, and you keep on repeating. I mean, that's the thing I like about spirituality. I love the you know, the saying who said, you know, the greatest piece of art, of work, is yourself. I mean, it's been said by many different people, but, you know, because it never ends and there's always greater heights, greater depths to go to. You know, there's always improvement, you know. I'm fascinated by my own spiritual development, where I've been and where it takes me. And when you reach places, you go, well, where does go from here? I mean, obviously, how does one go further, go elsewhere from here? Not because I was thinking, oh, I'm enlightened or anything, but just, it was just like, for me, I thought, how does one go beyond that? And then suddenly it will morph, the whole thing will just disintegrate, it will become ashes, and something new comes. And well, you start from the beginning, and it feels exciting again. I feel I'm reinventing myself again.
No, you referenced, and it's just so people know the context, we should come back to it. You referenced what you said has been going on for me lately. And I really appreciate that about our conversations, because as we talked about yesterday, I had a 2-day blackout last week where I lost 2 days and came home here on Wednesday and kind of woke up in hospital on Friday. And of course, you know, my doctor, I spoke to him after I spoke to you yesterday, and he's freaking out and referring me to all sorts of neurologists. And I think that's probably sensible to do the essential test to find out what's going on in my brain. But I prefer the conversation you and I had, which where you're going, well, this is a kind of a spiritual process where, you know, in Tibet, they would look at it this way and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, and it is a fascinating one, because you can't ever say it's this or that. But given that I'm sitting here and talking to you, and you seem to be reasonably sane, or as sane as I've ever known you, that actually nothing untoward happened. And it wasn't something that you did to yourself, you know, by taking stuff or whatever. It was more that it happened to you. And again, it was a resonance, you know, this thing of like things resonating that have no time and space, you know, energy. There's something about, which one can't describe it scientifically, of course, in some way, but there's some metaphysical understanding that space and time makes no difference, you know. And, for example, with Ma Qigong teacher, he used to say, oh, well, I'll show you how, and he used to be, when once or twice he would go to China, and he'd say, I'll tune into you during this day, you know, and I want you to clock when you feel I tuned into you. You know, exactly. And let's see. And then we do that. And nearly everybody who was then his student, and, you know, we're just talking about ordinary people, not necessarily psychic people, would say, oh, yeah, it was 1:17. And he said, yeah, that's exactly. And then he would say, I contacted you. And we go, oh, my God. Mm. And he said, why? Because space, with him, says makes no difference. The fact I was in Beijing makes no difference that you're in London. But also even more interesting is about time, that time folds into itself in a way and then comes back to itself. And there's this idea that that in physics it makes sense, and apologies that I can't explain it properly, that already time has happened from beginning to end, and it's going both ways. So the end point where everything arrives, or its ultimate, has like like a gong sound, imagine like a sound like a, that then resonates back through time. And we are following it. So we're being guided almost. We are following what is to happen because time is not linear. I mean, it's a wonderful head fuck, isn't it? And in that, what happened to you is you tuned in that moment going past St. Mary's Hospital. You were back to 18 years ago to the day. You were in that moment where you were witnessing quite extraordinarily, Jerry, this is very rare, simultaneously the birth and the death, the imminent death of your firstborn.
Mm.
I mean, can you imagine the impact that has on the psyche? I think this is what you're learning. And that triggered something in you that you could only respond to by leaving the body in some way, as you yourself said, your spirit leaving the body, making room for something more to come, which is where it happens. Because my teacher used to say this, he used to say, you are taken out of your body sometimes. You might lose a day. You might lose more. Probably usually it's a matter of hours. And you say, what happened? And then you're back in again. And he said, it's like, you know, when you're driving a car and you're driving and you suddenly don't know how you've driven 100 miles. I didn't drive the car. Who was driving the car? I was lost in some other thought. And yet you've driven yourself, negotiated through all sorts of roads. Is this the same thing? The automatic brain takes something, automatic takes over. Your spirit keeps something in the body to take care of itself. Whilst the egoic consciousness, whatever, is taken out so something new can be downloaded. Like, you know, like we download our computers. They've got to switch themselves off before they can start operating the new software.
No, I spoke to my doctor and we were going through the whole kind of neurological test, blah, 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 medical thing. And I said, look, let me throw this in because I think I'm a therapist. And so I look at things. And if as a doctor you go, no, that's nonsense, fine. But this event happened on the 18th, on my daughter's 18th birthday.
Mm.
Which was her birth was the most traumatic experience of my life. It was a very, very, you know, she nearly died.
Mm.
And then I came home after taking her out for lunch on her birthday and lost 2 days.
Mm.
And my experience, as you're talking, is exactly that. It's hard to talk about because for that, the duration of that 48-hour period, space and time didn't exist for me. I didn't exist. I don't have a sensation I was asleep. I have a sensation that I didn't exist. And the only thing I can compare it to in my life experiences is when I smoked 5-MeO-DMT, which is the buffo toad venom, which takes you to a near-death experience of egoless, non-oneness, you know, absolute oneness, non-self, beyond self. And yeah, last week I instead of a 15-minute narcotic trip, I had a 2-day absence from this world, which is fucking strange.
It's awesome. I think it's pretty awesome. I mean, from the outside, you know, looking in, for me, it feels awesome because it confirms that possibility of our own being, that of who we are, because you know, my conviction is that we are a tiny percentage here in this consciousness. We're only just one tiny percentage of our who we really are, that when we don't have a body. Okay, let's put it that way. And then so that what slips in and out is beyond, it's not under our egoic control. I am in charge of this. No, there's something much bigger and greater and more awesome that is still us, but not us in the identity sense of the word. And it can do something like it did to you. You know, yours was not a pathological state. Yours was the classic Tibetan thing of saying, if somebody just seems to be in a narcotic coma or it's just walking around and not registering anything around it, don't worry. Usually it will only last 3 days. It's a spiritual state. And, you know, you have to read that sort of stuff. I mean, I'm not so deep into the whole thing myself, but it is that. I mean, there really was, that happened and you, there you were, And for her, and I love sort of the little stories you tell me that sometimes you seem completely lucid and normal, and other times you're completely not yourself. And people were saying, you know, like the text you said that you were sending bizarre texts of numerals and numbers and and letters making no sense to anything. And that's fascinating to me. You know, that's sort of like, ah. But it's also something that I feel is that thing we're saying that, yes, we started this birth. What is death and what is birth and what is being reborn? What is this thing of being born again? You know, the old Gnostic thing, I am born again, you know, coming to life. It's more like I've come into life again, that I've left it and I've come into life again, you know. And be interesting to see where it happens, because this is just the beginning, you know, in the weeks and months from now on. It'd be interesting to see what you discover from that.
Yeah, I mean, this feels like the week after taking ayahuasca for the first time, where you go, what the fuck just happened there? That's going to take a while to digest and process. So it's kind of early days, but...
Absolutely. And I think for you, probably happened, you could slip and do that. That could happen and slip out of you like that because of what you have ingested to time. Often it takes, you know, life orchestrates, you know, a kind of accident or something where you go into supposed concussion and you're out of it. To me, it happened. I had a big thing. I don't know if you remember my car accident where somebody came into the back of me, bizarrely. And then I was fine. I was lucid. I was that. I mean, they had to cut me out of the car. You know, I had three ambulances, or two fire engines, you know, trying to, because they thought I'd, everybody, including myself, thought I'd broken my neck. It was so severe and I was just not moving. I said, I ain't moving, because I know if I move, I could really... Well, luckily I hadn't. And then for the next day or two, I can say very little to you about it. You know, it was like there were moments I was there and there was moments I weren't there. But I wasn't in bed. I wasn't asleep. I don't know what I was doing, but I wasn't, according to my wife. But I wasn't there. And that was a classic one. But for you... I think unusually it doesn't happen through some kind of traumatic impact. It happened through you tuning in to a traumatic incident in your life. As you said, possibly the most traumatic incident in your life to do with the birth of your daughter. And then you get flipped out and you get pulled out and you know, and rearrange. I think there's possibly, I would see it as new software has been downloaded and for you to discover what it is, you know.
No, everyone's been saying to me, God, how are you? You okay? And I'm going, yeah, I'm pretty good, actually, you know, so far. Yeah.
But the long and story where I was saying, I've not been the same since that accident.
Yeah.
I've been transformed slowly, slowly. And I have been at my best, my happiest.
It's weird, isn't it? We kind of have accidents when we need them.
Yeah. It's like I've been, finally, it was something like that happened. And it was like, parts of me that were split, not in sync, came together. Boom. Ah, I'm here. That's what it felt like. I'm finally here. You know, it took me 58 years, but I arrived, you know. And it's been great. You know, I mean, what a world to come into. Like, shit, now I come into the world with all this stuff going on. But I'm glad I'm finally here.
All right, it's a good time to be awake.
Yeah. What is the difference? Now, for me, it's a question that I haven't got the answer to. So I'm curious about it. Is an absent father worse or better than an abusive father? Now, we've got examples of both sitting here in this room. I, the most absent father you could get. How many minutes did he spend with me in my whole life? Let's say 3 hours at best. With you, he was a presence who's had a huge impact. So who has come off? What's that? What's the implications of that? Because sometimes I think, I used to think, well, it's good thing probably I didn't have a father at all, because I'm like a clean slate and I could become what was natural to me. But then it was only from my 50s, really, it took me that long. And that's after many years of personal work, spiritual work, that I realized there was a huge absence of the father. But there was such an absence.
And how did that affect you in your role as a father?
It didn't seem to make any difference. If anything, I like to think that it made me a really good father, a much better father. I became everything.
Couldn't have been a worse one.
I couldn't have been a worse one. But basically, it was like how to be totally present there for my children. Now, that is more true for my secondborn than my firstborn, because, you know, one second term round somehow, and also I was older, 5 years older. But at the same time, it made me realize that I had to be absolutely there as much as possible for my kids, physically as well as personally. And that's why also it drew me to become like more into the Reichian therapy, which is an attachment theory, which is, you know, you are there in contact with your children. I mean, literally both my kids spend the best part of the first year strapped against either my body or my woman's body, you know, the mother's body. It's like total contact, continuum concept. You know, I had a Lidlow's continuum concept, which I read way back in the 70s, that made such an impact with me. That was the first therapeutic awakening for me, was reading the continuum concepts, and then Primal Scream by Yanov. That really woke me up to my own psyche. But yeah, so in that sense, I felt it was
I said this to a client recently. It was one of those things I hadn't thought through. I just kind of heard myself say it. But I said, have you ever seen an African woman walking down the road with a screaming baby? You see women walking down the road with a screaming baby in a pushchair. You don't see someone with a baby strapped to them screaming. I've never seen that. They're chilled. They're just looking around or they're asleep.
And also, whenever my babies or my children cried, I'd pick them up and rock them or dance with them. In fact, because I'm into music, I dance with them, you know. So my daughter was born in 91, brilliant time to be born, because there was fantastic dance music, which I was keen into. I mean, I was one of these addicted collectors of 12 inches going down to Soho, rare grooves, you know, acid house and rave, you know, and ambient and psychedelic trance and all that. Anyway, so we'd stick it on and I'd dance this full on psychedelic, rave, bang, 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 you know, and she would just sleep. Finally.
Right.
She loved it because there was the contact, the rhythm. And I could really do it with her more than, you know, anybody could do it, because I really felt what they want is rhythm. They want movement. They want the physical reality. It's back to this animal.
But I talked about that again in another podcast with my friend Sam Roddick about, this is back to Tangier and the Rolling Stones, about really getting, and to the woman I had the thing with in Notting Hill, and buying this record in the Record and Tape Exchange in 1981. Called Brian Jones Introduces the Pipes of Pan, which were the master musicians of Jujuka. And I could never work out the time signatures. And it wasn't until Noor survived the pregnancy, because we'd had a lot of miscarriages. And I remember going to Yehudi Gordon's place and then putting the microphone on Janan's belly and hearing the fetal heartbeat. And it was like, it's the fucking master musicians of Jujuka. It's like kind of bang, 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 bang. And I thought, that's we all come from. And, you know, it's interesting to hear you were into rave music, because I was very involved in the illegal rave scene, and we would go and set up huge raves in stately homes and be chased around by the cops and shit like that. And I remember the first time we did one out in Kent at a stately home, and I remember going into the dance tent at about midnight and seeing 5,000 silhouettes of heads. You know, Andy Weatherall or someone was DJing, and you just saw the heads going up and down in unison to this incredibly repetitive beat. And I walked in off my tits and looked at it and thought, this is as old as we are.
Mm-hmm.
This is not new music. Mm-hmm. This is as old as the first person who picked up a mammoth bone and started hitting the ground with it in kind of, you know, some Stanley Kubrick type scenario. It's fucking right in our, it's our first heartbeat.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that for me, the most transcendent experiences, the most peak experiences, if I use it in that traditional, normal use term, is when I'm dancing. I have deep spiritual experiences. I mean, deep of oneness and unity and, you know, with the universe, with consciousness, profound, loving states. But the peak of transcendence and joy and ecstasy and liberation is when dancing.
You've been listening to the Jerry Yard Podcast. Thank you so much to Amadeus for dragging his ass through these autumnal, COVID-ridden streets to my place in London to sit and chat to me for an afternoon. It was a really enjoyable experience for me. I hope you got something out of it. A bit of free therapy, if nothing else. And thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you to any of you who have left me ratings or even a review. It all helps. And got some really special guests coming up for you over the next few weeks. So keep tuning in and see you next time. Bye.